Blog Talk Radio.
I think it's like 73 degrees, and I see the wind is blowing, and I don't know if I think we're set for a storm for the weekend, but it's a good day today. That's what counts, and I have a good show. I'm going to be noshing during the show. Well, what the cheese doesn't always stand alone, as they say. We got Brent Dellman, who's known as the cheese guy, and the cheeses are kosher. Well, what does that mean? Is it kosher? He not only imports his cheese from the United States and Italy, he makes his own cheese in his basement setup. Well, cheddar cheese is just one variety, and the milk may come from cows, sheep, and goat, and all the varieties don't taste the same. Well, we're going to talk what creates difference in taste and texture, and we'll do some tasting as well as I place the cheeses on Italian crackers with apple butter maple syrup. After all, you don't need cream cheese simply by placing it on a spoon. But first, here's a message from our sponsor.
Hey, Martha, why do you smile? I was just thinking, I'm here at Ronnie Brook Farms eating delicious grass, not being injected with some synthetic hormones. I just gave birth to another cutie calf and don't even have to deal with any bull. I hear you, Mar. You know what they call cows that can't give milk? No, what, Sal? Utter failure. So, where is our big daddy Ronnie? Probably somewhere exercising, doing yogurt. At Ronnie Brook Farms, you'll find the best of dairy products. Our milks vary in butterfat, from non-fat to heavy cream. Enjoy the creamy yogurts from the cup or one that you can simply drink with the best of culture without artificial thickeners or additives. We don't have sour cream. We do have creme fraiche. Butter is better when you can choose cinnamon toast to spread on bread or pancakes. And since we scream for ice cream any time of year, you'll love our 16% butterfat. Do you remember getting bottled milk delivered, opening it to find the cream on the top? That is how you'll find our sweet-tasting cream-lined milk. I'll hand it to you, Sal, or milk may get past your eyes. But certainly not homogenized. Ronnie Brook Farms, where cows always seem to be in a good mood. Check us out at www.ronniebrook.com.
Okay, and now we're going to talk about cheese. So, hello, Brent.
Hi, Merle. How are you?
Okay. So, just I guess you just heard the commercial.
I did. That was very cute. I'm gonna use some of your material.
All right.
That's the utmost flattery. If I can use some of your humorous material, it was very cute.
That's okay. I'm not in the business anymore. So let's get to talking about cheese. How do you let's start with, like, since you make your own cheeses, how you go about doing it, and how it is each one, like, how do they get produced so they don't all taste the same?
So what I do is I partner up with small farms, small family-owned farms, primarily in the Northeast, Vermont, upstate New York, and also, as you mentioned, some small family farms outside of the region. But about 60 to 70% of my cheeses come from the Northeast, and the other 30% are from Ohio, some small Amish farms in Ohio and Wisconsin and Italy, Israel, Argentina. So there's a handful of other farms that I work with, but primarily up in the area. I make about 35 different varieties. And what I do, there's a term in the craft brewing world called a gypsy brewer. And I'm sort of like a gypsy cheesemaker. What I do is I go out to small farms and I partner up with the farmers, and we make cheese together. I bring a lot of my own ingredients, and I invest in equipment that is unique to my production. I bring in my own cheese molds and things like that are called brine tanks, all kinds of things like that that are unique to the production of my cheese. So I don't own a cheese making facility. So once the cheese is made, on the farm, and by the way, is what I've done is partnered up with some of these small farms, Connecticut, upstate New York, Vermont, a lot of these areas where the farms are diminishing, the number of farms are disappearing, and it's really a shame because, you know, up in the Northeast here, the land and development, the land has become so valuable, so much more valuable than a farmer, a lot more valuable for the farmer to sell, especially second and third generation farm families, for them to sell their land for development than the money that they would be receiving for selling their milk on the local market. Excuse me. So they get pennies on the dollar for selling their milk in the local market. So what we do is we create a value-added product, the high-end artisan cheese that we then produce together. So it's a win-win-win. Win for the farmers and win for me as an artisan cheesemaker, and a win for the consumers. So it's really a, like I say, a win-win-win. And the farmers, it enables them to stay in business. So I go out to the farms and we produce the cheese at their farm, hopefully, ideally. Cheese is actually made in what's called a creamery. These small artisan cheesemaking facilities are called creameries. So very often they'll have a creamery right down the road or even as part of their facility on the farm, and we'll make the cheese there. And then I bring the cheese back to an aging facility, which is mine, and that's in Yonkers, New York, where I age the cheese. And there's a term called affinage. It's the art of aging the cheese, maturing the cheese. So the part of the whole process is obviously the production, making the cheese, but then aging the cheese. And a lot of my cheeses are considered hard cheeses, and they're aged for anywhere from 6 months to 2 or 3 years, and then the cheese fully develops. So that's sort of the process. And then you asked about how they become different. Well, there's literally thousands of different varieties of cheese, which is an amazing thing when you think about it. That cheese, all cheese comes from milk. And so cheese starts from an animal, obviously, and it depends on which animal that it comes from. So the primary animals that cheese comes from are cows, sheep, goat, and can you take a guess what the fourth most popular animal in the world is that produces milk for cheese making? Any idea?
I know somebody said camel.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There is a lot of camel milk. It's interesting to our American way of life to think about camel milk or camel cheese. But there is a lot of camel. That's not the next most popular in the world. I'll tell you, there's a lot of animals, horse and yak and all kinds of things that are the cheese is made of, but it's the water buffalo. So the water buffalo makes in Italy the original
mozzarella.
Buffalo
mozzarella.
Yep. So that's very popular in Italy, and even in India they have buffalo water buffalo that they use the milk for cheese. So anyway, so it first starts out by it depends on which animal that the milk is going to come from, and there are a number of other factors: what the animals are grazing on, what variety or what breed. So within, say, for example, cows, you know, there are numerous different breeds of cows, and they each produce a different quality milk. They have some have a higher fat content and higher protein and things like that. So it depends on the animal, depends on the breed, depends on what they're eating. So if they're grazing in the fields or if they're being fed grain or hay or whatever they're being fed, you know, if you think about a human woman who breastfeeds, they're always warned that you know, not to eat certain foods while they're breastfeeding, because the tastes and the nutrients and everything comes through the milk. Same with the animals.
Mm-hmm.
So it also depends on the season. So there's seasonality in cheese making and milk producing. So if they're grazing on certain herbs and grasses during the spring or the fall, or spring or summer, or hay in the fall and the winter, that's going to come through in the taste of the milk and the fat content of the milk. So it depends what they're eating. Then probably the most interesting, or the thing that differentiates cheese the most, are the bacterial cultures that are then put into the milk in order to make cheese. So there's something called a Swiss culture and a cheddar culture and all these other things. And these are cultures that have been developed over sometimes even thousands of years, definitely hundreds of years. And they've been developed especially in Europe. And there are these cultures that have been propagated over the centuries. So they've been isolated. And so on the market, you can buy, there are a few companies that sell these, and you can mix and match different cultures to get the type of variety of cheese that you're looking for. But you take the milk, and you add, one of the first things when you're making the cheese, you add these bacterial cultures, and these cultures then begin to acidify the milk, and it starts the process of milk becoming cheese. It starts to coagulate the milk, and then later on you can put in rennet if it's going to be a hard cheese. I know that's a topic that we want to discuss in further detail. But
sure.
So there are a number of other things. You add salt, and you heat the milk, and you press. So what happens is, as the milk coagulates, it becomes like the old nursery rhyme, curds and
whey.
And the idea is to isolate the curds. The curds are the solid, and the whey is the liquid that drains off. We want to continue to try through all these different processes, heating and pressing the curds and salting, and we want to continue to isolate these curds so that they become more of a solid. And the curds are the fat and the proteins that are being isolated, the casein, which is also part of the sugars and the fats and the proteins, all of that that we continue to isolate and turn into curds and drain off the whey, and then that becomes cheese. So that's in a nutshell how there are so many different varieties of cheese around the world.
Wow. Now, is cheese something like you have to develop a taste for the way, you know, in terms of like wine?
Oh, sure. Sure. You know, if you ask people, cheese is one of, as you know, people are very passionate about their food and their wine and their spirits and beverages, but in particular cheese, and just like wine, if you ask people from, especially from Europe or the Middle East or Latin America, many, many places, you know, Americans haven't really come to appreciate cheese like a lot of the rest of the world until the last, I'd say, 25, 30 years. But if you go into a typical specialty store like a Whole Foods or, you know, here in the New York area, Fairway or some of the specialty chains, Zabar's and all the other specialty stores, you'll see their ever-expanding cheese counters and the cheese refrigerator cases. And so there are literally some of these stores have hundreds of varieties, whereas 20 years ago, I'm guessing they had probably just a couple of dozen. And so it's Americans' palates are expanding because Americans are traveling more. But yeah, it's absolutely a developed and acquired appreciation. You know, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know, and
yeah,
how much more there, how much more there is to learn and to appreciate. And certain cultures, you know, if you think about specific cultures, like if I ask you what cheese do you associate coming from Greece?
I would say feta cheese.
Yeah. If you ever speak to a Greek about feta, you watch the passion in their eyes and their voice and their hands and the, you know, and if you ask, you know, a French person about brie or camembert or an Italian about parmesan or mozzarella, all these things, they evoke so much passion and so much. So a lot of people grow up on these things. They're weaned on these tastes. And then others, like I say, Americans, who it's some of these tastes are more recently acquired, it becomes appreciated and learned, and you know, a lot of it is it's a lot of fun. You go to your specialty stores, and you can ask the cheesemongers, the cheese person, the expert working behind the counter, ask them questions. Don't be afraid to ask specific questions about cheeses that you're looking to, maybe you're looking to make a specific dish or you're looking to pair with a certain wine or, you know, anything that you're looking to do. Maybe you have a certain acquired taste if you like sharper cheeses or milder or creamier or stinky or whatever they happen to be. So it is an acquired taste, but you have to sort of go out and seek it. It's out there. We're like I say, in America, we've come to appreciate it, like a lot of the other wonderful foods that we've come a long way with here in the U.S.
Well, I grew up basically, it was either cream cheese, Munster, or Velveeta.
Well, you know, it's and that's common. That's typical of America, and it's also. I happen to be of the Jewish faith, and my parents and grandparents. Well, my parents were American born, but grandparents, and great grandparents were from Eastern Europe, and the tastes that they brought from Eastern Europe were generally the creamier, what they call fresh cheeses. And some of the cheese, like you said, cream cheese, farmer's cheese, you know, things that, you know, Jews were known for, cheesecake here in the New York area, those are all fresh cheeses. And those were brought from Eastern Europe. They don't require rennet, which I mentioned previously, rennet, which sets the cheese and coagulates the curds to help the cheese become a hard cheese. But there weren't many rennet set cheeses. There were a lot of these more fresh cheeses. The farmers and even ricotta, fresh ricotta, the Italian style cheese, and as you said, those are the types that you grew up with, sort of milder, fresher.
Yeah. So now, what makes cheese kosher or not kosher?
So the main thing is that during the production of cheese, there needs to be some supervision to make sure that there are no non-kosher ingredients going into the production. And for those listeners that aren't familiar with kosher, is a set of laws that traditional Jews abide by that were brought down through the Bible and the Talmud, our teachings, and it describes what animals you're allowed to eat from, or which animals you're allowed to eat, birds, fish, all different. It sets forth how an animal is supposed to be slaughtered. There are a number of different provisions that are that have come down through our traditions that designate what is to be kosher and what is not to be kosher. So when it comes to cheese, first of all, the milk has to come from a kosher animal. So, for example, a camel is not an animal that is considered kosher. So we would not be able, if one keeps kosher, one would not be able to consume camel cheese. And back in the day, Europe and different places, there were a lot of, at the local farmers markets, one of the issues was, if you want to call it, bait and switch. They used to, not with camels necessarily, or there weren't definitely in Europe, but with horses or sometimes other animals. So a horse is not a kosher animal. Sometimes somebody would pass off horse milk as cow's milk. And so that obviously would not be kosher. So that could not go into the production of kosher cheese. So first is that the milk must come from a kosher animal. Secondly, so then, as I mentioned, during the production of cheese, the supervision takes place. What I do in my with my company is the facilities that I team up with are these small farms. They are not kosher facilities, so I have to bring in what's called a mashgiach, a supervising rabbi, who then looks over the equipment. Very often we have to do an additional cleaning, an additional sanitization of the plant, of the facility, and to make sure that some of the non-kosher ingredients are not going to be coming through the production into our cheese production. There are things like a lot of people probably know that keeping kosher means that we don't consume pork products. So very often there are different slicing machinery, and if you've ever seen some of the rolls like fresh mozzarella with prosciutto in the middle or different things, so some of these facilities do use non-kosher ingredients in different productions. So the equipment very often has to be put into extremely hot boiling water in order to make sure that especially the slicing or anything coming into contact with the cheese, any of the equipment must be completely clean, which is, I think, a good thing all around. It can't hurt to have extra clean facility and production equipment. Production facility is clean. And then the main thing in terms of some of the hard cheeses in particular is the addition of the rennet. So rennet normally comes from the lining of a stomach of a calf. And this rennet, it's an enzyme. And just to give you a brief background on the rennet, are you familiar with rennet? You've heard the term or what the ingredient is?
Yeah, I've heard the term. I've never used it though.
So rennet, and most people are not familiar with it. A lot of foodies have heard of it. But other than that, and some vegetarians are familiar with it because they ask for rennet-free cheese. So rennet, and like I say, to give you a quick background, how was cheese produced? The legend has it that there was a person, a wandering nomad in the Middle East thousands of years ago, and he was traveling around with an animal skin carafe or a flask, and he put milk in it as he was traveling, and at the end of his journey he realized that it coagulated and turned into a hard cheese. And so what happens is the enzymes from the stomach of a calf, a baby ruminant or a calf or a lamb, those enzymes that line the stomach of the baby animals are used to break down and digest the mother's milk. So it does. It's the same process that's used to make the cheese. It begins the breakdown of the sugars in the milk. So that's what it takes the lactose, the milk sugar, and it turns it into lactic acid. So that same chemical reaction that takes place in the stomach of the animal is then used in the production of cheese. So a baby calf or lamb or whatever, generally a calf, is slaughtered in order to take the enzymes, the rennet from the stomach lining. And then those enzymes in most cheeses, the traditional European cheeses, that those enzymes are then put into the milk and then helps the coagulation process of the milk. In kosher cheese, 99.99% of the time, we don't use animal rennet. And I would say that, I mean, I've never in my lifetime ever, I think for all intents and purposes and for our discussion, you have to assume that that animal rennet is not going to be used and is not acceptable in kosher cheese. There are some loopholes and there are some arguments that have been made that allow it to be acceptable. But one of the provisions in keeping kosher is that milk and meat cannot be mixed. So that's part of it. There are also, like I mentioned before, a true supervision process of milk and cheese making is normally done by someone who is a Jewish person who is observant of keeping kosher and keeping some of the other rituals, like keeping the Sabbath, different things like that. So normally the supervision of the cheese making process, it's been done for thousands of years. This supervision process was done by a traditional, observant, religious Jewish individual. And so that's part of the process. So the rennet, the animal rennet, is not used in our cheese. We use microbial rennet as a substitute. It comes from a fungus. And one of the attractions to kosher cheese and to my brand, which, if I may give a shameless plug here, the brand, the Cheese Guy.
That's okay, yeah.
So the cheeseguy.com is my website. But so my brand, the Cheese Guy, we do not use any animal rennet in our production, in our products, in order for it to be kosher. And we also have a nice following amongst vegetarians. They seek out our cheeses, as well as do Muslims and Seventh Day Adventists. So there are a number of different groups that look for cheese without rennet. Yes, I'm sorry.
So let me ask you, if I had a similar cheese, like let's say a mild cheddar that's kosher, mild cheddar that's not kosher, would I taste any difference?
Well, it depends who you ask. Part of my goal is to prove that cheese with non-animal rennet or kosher cheese can be just as good or even better than a cheese with animal rennet or kosher certified. And that's the response that I get. We do farmers markets. My products are sold in Whole Foods and Fairways and the specialty kosher stores in Brooklyn and Queens, Manhattan, and Mrs. Green's and Morton Williams. So a number of the chains. We do demos all the time, and people every day comment that it's some of the best cheese they've ever had in their lives. There are purists, people from Europe, who will tell you that they can taste the difference if you, for example, a Parmesan or a Pecorino Romano or a Brie or something, a traditional type of cheese that requires animal rennet to be in. If you make it without the animal rennet, there are people who tell you they can taste the difference. I can tell you that we make a Pecorino Romano, a sheep milk cheese that comes from Italy. It's the first time that what's called a PDO or DOP, one of the protected names. You know, in Europe, they have protected names like champagne. Everybody knows about champagne, right?
Right.
It must come from the Champagne region, and it has to contain a specific varietal of grape and made in a specific way, the wine. So in Europe, cheese, meat, wines, a lot of the names are protected. And you can't make, for example, you cannot make a sparkling white wine from in California and call it champagne. It would be illegal because it is one of these names that's protected. So throughout Europe, there are dozens and dozens of these protected names, and also in the cheese world. One of the protected names is Pecorino Romano, Parmigiano Reggiano. People know as sort of the king of cheese. Parmigiano Reggiano must come from the Parma region of Italy and made in a specific production method with a certain type of milk and age for a specific amount of time. That's said it come from certain type of cows. All these kind of things. So Pecorino, we are now making a Pecorino Romano with non-animal rennet. As far as I know, it's one of the first times that that one of these traditional cheeses is made without the animal rennet. And it was allowed by the consortium in Italy because they felt that it did not alter the taste and the final product of the cheese enough so that it shouldn't be allowed. So you understand the point there there are the purists who will tell you, yes, you can taste the difference, but here's an example of one that where a group of experts ruled in our favor and said, you know what, make your kosher product using your non-animal rennet, and they experimented and everybody tried. We requested the permission to do it over a period of a couple of years as the cheese was produced, and it was shown to be similar quality and similar outcome to the original Pecorino Romano.
Well, let's do some cheese tasting right now. If you're doing, cheese tasting, like the way they do wine, they give you, I guess, from dry to sweet. So how would you do a cheese tasting?
You want to go from least intense to most intense. So, and it generally corresponds to the texture of a cheese. So if a cheese is softer, not always. There are many exceptions like Brie and Camembert and some of the stinky, pungent French cheeses. But for the most part, if a cheese is softer and creamier, it's going to be on the more mild end of the spectrum. And if something is harder, more firm, crumbly texture, it's going to be sharper and stronger. So,
okay. What I've done is I have these the Italian crackers and the apple butter that has maple syrup in it. Because I mean, it's not, you know, you don't put cream cheese on your hand and lick it off. Or put a spoon of cream cheese. So when you're eating cheese, I'm guessing you just don't have a piece of cheese.
So
you have
could,
it with
or,
something.
Or, you know, it's like anything. It's like wine. It's like anything, any pairing. You know, what you want to have a wonderful gastronomic experience with, you can have it with that item alone, or if you pair it with something else, you hope that it raises the experience, that it makes it even better by pairing it with something else. So the crackers, what I would recommend in terms of crackers, so you have, I know you have the plain crackers with, they have just a little bit of sea salt on them, and I think a tad bit of olive oil. So the crackers, you generally want a plain cracker so that you're not going to overpower the taste of the cheese. And the apple butter, I would not recommend that with all the cheeses. I know that's one of my products that's made up in Vermont, and it's made primarily to go to pair with specific cheeses. So if you could tell me a little bit more about the cheese.
Okay. I'll tell you what I have here in front of me. I have five different ones. I have the Chev. How do you pronounce that?
Mm-hmm,
The creamy goat cheese.
Mm-hmm,
I have
okay.
The one that's the raw milk. Goat cheese.
Okay.
I have the aged cheddar.
That's also a raw milk, correct?
Yeah. I have the Montaggio. Yes, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
How do you pronounce?
Yeah.
Montaggio. Right.
Montaggio.
Yeah.
That's one of our proprietary names that we've developed, a cheese that is from the north of Italy. Yeah.
I have the grappa.
Okay. Yeah, the
right.
Bastardo
no.
del grappa. Right.
Or maybe I don't have. No. Wait a minute. No, I don't have that one. I didn't open that one. That's the stinky one, right? You told me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't open that one. I have. The double ale cheddar,
mm-hmm.
which
okay.
you said is like the most popular. When is the ale put in, by the way?
The ale is put in during the make of the cheese, during the making of the cheese. So what we do is, there are traditional European cheeses where they produce the cheese, and then at the very end, after the wheel of cheese or the block of cheese is made, they soak it in beer or wine or spirits. But what we do, we tried to take it to another level. We actually add the beer in to the cheddar during the making process. So it's the curds are soaked in the beer while we're making the cheese. So you really get an intense flavor of beer in the cheese.
Okay, so of the cheeses that I said, which should I go through first?
So I would say probably the raw milk goat cheddar. And let me just mention that raw milk means milk that has not been pasteurized, and there are laws in the United States that require that a cheese be aged for a minimum of 60 days If it's raw milk, the milk is heated, but it's not heated to the point of pasteurization. In Europe, they don't have the same laws that we do, but so our raw milk cheeses must be aged over 60 days. So this raw milk goat cheddar, and the reason for the raw milk is because two reasons. Number one is that when you pasteurize cheese, obviously it's for health reasons that we kill off. The intention is to kill off the bacteria, the bad bacteria, but in the process we also kill off a lot of the good bacteria. And so the idea of keeping the milk raw and not pasteurizing it is to retain some of the original flavor of the milk, and as well some of the good bacteria.
I have the aged variety. That's what I have.
Okay. All right. Good. Okay. So yeah, so, I would say start the goat in general. I mean, it's a little tangy and tends to be, but it's also this goat cheddar during the aging of this cheese. It tends to sort of mellow out and it becomes sort of a mild, creamy cheese. Maybe you start out with that one. And these are
just
still
everybody, you're hearing me crunch on the cracker.
Are you taking a fresh slice from the bar?
Am I what?
Are you cutting it as we're speaking?
Oh no. Actually, I think it told me to leave to take it at the room temperature.
Yeah.
So I've prepared
yeah.
this and let it come to room temperature.
Okay. And then but speaking, are you cutting it right from the block?
No, I didn't want to take, this was my concern, I wanted to take them all out and have them sit at room temperature, then I have to put it back in the refrigerator. I didn't know if that was good, so I just took a piece of each and did this so I can do this for the show.
Okay. So my recommendation is if you're going to have a cheese party or you're making a cheese platter, leave the chunk of cheese whole until you're ready to consume it, and then take it's been a few minutes for you, so that's not a big deal, but just to as no pun intended, as you cut the cheese, you can imagine how many times I get a chuckle out of that in my line
sure.
of business. So as you take a chunk of the cheese, slice of the cheese off, it's that's the best way to use it to bite into it is fresh off the block.
Okay.
So tell me what you're.
It's mild. I'm getting mildness. I'm not getting one of the things I have dealing with the, I guess, goat cheese. It tastes like goat, or it tastes like I'm having a lamb chop sometimes.
A lot of people say that. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Okay. So which one should I go next?
Go with the aged Havarti. Now, Havarti is a traditional Danish cheese. This one that you're trying is made in the U.S. that comes from Wisconsin, and what I've done with that is to take a normally very mild, good melting cheese. Havarti is very often melted in Mexican type dishes or over vegetables or in quiches or different things. It's a great melting cheese, and it's normally very mild. So what we did is we aged it a little bit longer to try to evoke a little bit more flavor out of it. So tell me telling what you're getting.
Yeah, a little tangy because of the agedness.
Mm-hmm.
But mild enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's a little bit more a little bit more flavor than the goat, would you say?
Yeah.
Okay. Could you see it as a good melting cheese?
Yeah, because I'm also looking at making a dish with mushrooms and cheese.
Mm-hmm. The Havarti would be wonderful for that.
Okay. Then I have... What should we go to next?
So you have the double ale and you have the Montaggio and you have... Now, did you want to... Did you want to try the fresh goat cheese, or you want to skip that?
Well, I have that in front of me.
Okay, so in terms of texture, that's a cheese that it's good for pairing with white wine. It's normally a big cheese that's eaten during during summer months. It's a light, refreshing type of cheese that is normally people crumble over salads. You can make a beet salad with candied pecans and a little bit of arugula, something like that. But or goat cheese is also used as a substitution for cream cheese. It's that same spreadable consistency, and it's generally easily digestible. But many people do say, as you mentioned, that it's one of the term that people often use is that it's sort of barnyardy, or it does. It reminds them of a farm, the smells or the taste of a farm. So if that's too overpowering for you, we can skip to the next. But that would also be, I'd say that would fall in line. It's a little bit more, a little bit stronger, a little bit more tangy, almost citrusy. Then also a little bit of barnyard in there.
Yeah. Actually, I expected this one. Wait a minute. The fresh and creamy to not be crumbly at all.
But you're finding that it is crumbly?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then...
And then I would, okay, so again, Matt, just to review, we have the double ale cheddar and the Montaggio, and refresh my memory.
The last one here I have is the double ale. The only one I didn't open up was the...
Bastardo?
The Grappa.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I would go with the double ale next.
Okay.
The double ale comes from Vermont. It's made with the milk, from one particular farm. And I go up there every few weeks and collaborate with the cheesemakers, and we bring up our own beer from local microbrews. It's one of our award-winning cheeses, the double ale cheddar. So we use a couple of different microbrews, just some different craft beers from the New York area. Sometimes we use Captain Lawrence, sometimes Yonkers Brewing Company. We've used a company in upstate New York by the name of Schmaltz Brewing Company. Austin area. The Schmaltz Brewing Company has hilarious names. You have to check out their names. They have one called He Brew. And we also
wait a minute. Where's the company?
It's in upstate, a little bit north of Albany.
I thought they were in Brooklyn. No?
you know, maybe they have a an office or their headquarters in Brooklyn. I think
to remember,
because
I remember I remember that particular beer, and because I was speaking with them, because I thought it was kind of amusing that they had these beers. Okay.
Yeah. They have some wonderful beers.
Yes, and it's really nice cheese. The combination of the beer. And I'm just wondering if, okay, if you think that using some Havarti and this, and the cheese with the beer would be a good combination with the mushrooms.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. People tell me that I've never made it myself, but people tell me they melt it in soups all the time, mushroom, barley, and French onion. So I'm sure it'll be a that would be a great combination. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to try tonight. I have I have the crimini mushrooms out, and not the oyster. Maybe it's the oyster. Yeah, the crimini and oyster mushrooms ready to roll for the evening. To mix it.
Nice. Are you gonna?
And then I'm gonna be putting it over. What I'm putting it over, which will be interesting, might be interesting to you to hear about. I have ramen noodles, but they're not made from wheat. They're made from rice. A company called Lotus Foods. And this is one of the things they make. So you're eating, like, the best rice in the world kind of stuff. And they started making these ramen noodles.
Are they gluten-free?
You know, using... Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So where you would use, and, of course, they're quick enough to make. Mm-hmm. All of their rice that they use are all have, like, really nutritious.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're combining this...
made from different grains?
Yeah, different grains. And one of the best, by the way, is a one called Forbidden Rice, which they were able to get in China to do. And it's a short-grain black rice.
Yeah,
that's really kind of nutty.
It's a beautiful rice if you've ever seen it. Some restaurants will use it as a dessert. It becomes almost purple in color.
Yes.
Yeah, right?
Yep. Anyway, so that's what I'm going to be doing to prepare is this the mushroom and cheese over the ramen noodles.
Are you going to sauté the mushrooms?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And will you be adding a broth to the
Yeah, but I haven't decided what I want to use because kind of the mushrooms, you know, create its own broth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or just the, as opposed to the broth. See, with the ramen noodles, you could either, because they also have packets with, like, miso soup.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have all these different herbs or spices and whatever. I prefer it plain, and then doing whatever, and then throwing whatever I want on it. But I think in terms of taste wise, because I'm looking at the cheese and the mushrooms and probably just a little salt will create. And probably maybe I'll add either butter or something like that. But this is what I'm going to do tonight because I want to see the combination of the cheeses with the mushrooms.
You know, I'm getting a sense that I'll be real curious to know how it works out. I'm envisioning the sort of hoppiness of the, do you know what I mean? When like the hoppiness from the beer comes out in the beer cheddar, and then the earthiness of the mushrooms. I think that may be a real nice combination.
Oh yeah, I think so.
They all start out with that sort of earthiness, the grains in the beer and the mushrooms. Yeah, I think that could work.
Do you have any ideas, by the way, of combining the cheese with mushrooms, different types of mushrooms?
I mean, typically people melt, you know, a good melting cheese. And you know, you think about mushroom soup and different creamy type cheeses. But again, the flavor that I associate with the mushrooms is that earthiness. So you know, you don't want to have anything that is going to overpower. You want to have something that's going to complement. And I think the double ale cheddar with the beer in it could be a nice pair. And and so either melting it or, you know, just you could use it on the side. You could use one of the cheeses. Here's a thought that I have. Would you like to try that Montaggio next?
I'm far from the kitchen.
Ah, okay.
Is that the one I said I had? No, it's the grappa that I did. No, I didn't. You know, I already tried the Montaggio. I went. Oh no, that's once I ate it. I said, no, this is the Montaggio.
Uh huh. And what did you think?
And
of
I
it?
Just found it
a little strong.
That's the best. Yeah, okay. It's like I was finding it like the almost as if I was having a blue cheese.
Yeah. It does have some of those blue notes. Yeah. There's a similar cheese. It's called Montaggio with an S. It comes from northern Italy. So this
right.
is, we combined Montaggio with formaggio, which means cheese in Italy in Italian.
Ah.
And that's one of our trademark names in our cheeses. It also comes from a similar region in the north of Italy. And but it is a little bit more pungent than the Montaggio. So it's a strong cheese. So one of the thoughts that I had was that to use it just as a table cheese next to your next to the mushroom and ramen dish, and not even to grate it or melt it.
Right.
You know, another thought could be the you might try shredding the aged goat cheddar over the mushroom ramen dish. I think that might pair nicely.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess we'll find out later this evening how it came out.
Yeah. Montaggio, you know, then is like I say, a wash drying cheese. It's put in a brine solution and then some bacterial cultures, and they wash the outside of the wheel, so it gets that, it develops some new flavor profiles and new, all kinds of new molds and yeasts and things that grow in there, and it develops that strong flavor. So yeah, that's a stronger, as I mentioned, and we're trying to go from mildest to most intense, and that would be toward the end of the cheese spectrum there.
Okay. Well, okay. I'm going to end the show and eat and write. That's what I'm going to do now. And I'm going to let you go because it's getting closer and closer to sundown.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, we're good. Yeah. It's unfortunately, as summer comes to an end, it's getting earlier and earlier.
I'll also get in touch with you because I wanted to look to see, in particular, if there's the ones that I had originally chosen, if there was a reason. Because I think some of them that I chose, I think were I was going toward the more mild cheeses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't sure. But we'll get into this another time. Perhaps
By the way, I'm sorry. Did you try the raw cheddar, raw milk, sharp cheddar?
Yes.
Okay. It just came to me that that was one that that I think we were gonna. Okay, that would also. It's a creamy cheese. That would go. I think that would go real well with your mushroom dish. Actually, maybe leave the Havarti and go with that one because it'll.
Oh, okay. Matter of fact,
yeah.
I think what I'm going to do is do the raw milk with the with a little bit of the beer, the one with the beer.
Mm-hmm.
As a combination.
Yeah, I think that's a very good combination.
We'll have to stay tuned
to find out.
Well, I've gone to places where, you know, where they make their own beer and they serve beer soup. And there's always cheese in it.
Yeah. It's a great combination.
Yeah. I mean, people think wine and cheese and not necessarily beer and cheese. I'll have to do that. I like Blue Moon, so let's see what would go best with a Blue Moon beer.
Yeah, well, you know, have you heard of a plowman's lunch in England and Ireland? You know, a typical worker's lunch has been a beer and a piece of cheddar and a crusty piece of bread and that's your lunch. There's a reason that it's been a wonderful combination for a long time. Cheddar
no
and
potato.
Beer. That's for dinner.
Oh, okay.
So
it was great having you on the show.
It's been wonderful. You got to eat and learn. What a great combination, right?
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, have a great day. Good Shabbos.
Thank you. A good Shabbos to you. And I'll look forward to hearing how your dishes turned out.
Okay. Take care.
Take care. You too, Mo. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Okay. So I'm going to end the show. And the G's, I guess. So for everybody, wherever you are, I really wish I had this, but I have to play. Okay, I have a commercial here. Come on, let's go. There we are.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale.
Yes, and you can get these absolutely wonderful brownies on www.brownies.com. Yes, I'm up for a brownie, but I guess I'll wait to get it sent to me. So everybody, have a great day. Evening, or whatever time it is for you. And may Trump not get into office. Goodbye, everybody.